I'm Richard Porter.
I'm Johnny Smith.
And this is Smith and Sniff, a podcast in which two friends talk about cars. And this week, James Bond. I was talking to a mate of mine the other week, and he has this belief that all actors who've played James Bond get to keep the cars from the movies that they were in as James Bond.
What?
Yeah, and I don't... The thing is, I don't think he's joking. I think he sort of secretly believes it. And then, you know, when people do that thing where they go, oh, no, of course I'm kidding. Well, it's like that. I think he really sort of secretly hopes that it's true. But I started thinking about it. I was like, well, now, hang on. Who got a good deal there if that was true? Lazenby.
Yeah.
Only gets one car, but yeah, it's an old school 60s Aston DBS, and
I like that DBS.
Yeah, I like that DBS. They're nice, aren't they?
I like that shape. Yeah, yeah. I actually prefer that shape controversially to a DB5 or 6, but that's just me.
No, do you know what? I do as well.
And I just think it's a more muscular car.
Yeah, and I actually like that four headlight grille on the DBS. I think more than the way, you know, they changed it to the single headlights for the later V8. They used to call it the V8 Saloon, I think, didn't they? But it wasn't a saloon, it's a coupe.
It was, yeah.
But yeah, no, that DBS, I think that's an handsome car. Yeah. And so, yeah, Lazenby gets to take one of those home. Bullet hole in the screen, but otherwise intact.
Well, windscreen's a consumable item.
Exactly. I mean, also, let's assume he got to take it home in the late 60s. I think parts supply would have been pretty okay for for that. So he's okay. But, you know, he only did one film, so he gets one car, but it's a good car. So lucky George Lazenby. He had something nice to remember his Bond days by...
His Bond day?
Bond day. Did they do the whole thing in a day?
Yeah, yeah, really low budget back then. Yeah, they just went, no, we need to film an action epic film, but we've got 20 hours to do it in. Yeah.
What struck me is then you get to the Bonds who had a bit more of a work ethic and decided to stick around.
Hang on, are we talking about Irish bloke?
Brosnan.
Brosnan, Piers.
Well, Brosnan, now, yes and no with Brosnan.
Okay.
Because
you got the 750 IL.
No, because it's all smashed up. It drove off the top floor of a car park. So, yes, he's got a 750 IL, but it's banana shaped.
Yeah, but salvage, you know, it's still money in salvage.
Do you think he went,
okay, I reckon I'll
take it. But he's having it reshelled.
He's very breathy, but it sits in his back garden next to a compost heap under a really shabby tarp. And you go,
that's
are
the
you
problem.
Do anything with that
no,
totally destroyed?
I haven't got around to it. I think he's putting off the 750 project again. He was never very happy about the Z3.
No. Well, no.
Got a bum deal there. Yo-ho, I'm James Bond. Brilliant. I'm gonna really nail the part of 007. And I might get to take home a car. What car have you got in this film? Oh, for fuck's sake.
I've got is it a 2 litre? I think it might
I think it was a 1.9.
Oh, yeah.
Can't even quite stretch it to 2 litre.
That's not Bond spec, is it?
No, it's rubbish.
Roadster.
But at least it still works, because all it basically did was sort of drive through a field. And then some CIA agents popped up. It was a really underwhelming car all round.
It was an underwhelming, car moment for Bond, I feel. Whereas, for your eyes only, your eyes only had the old indestructible 2CV, right?
This brings me to Roger Moore and the cars that Roger Moore got to take home. Now, it seems on the surface that, you know, Rog did quite well. But if you think about it, he's got... So picture, I know he's no longer with us, but picture, when he was still alive, Sir Roger Moore's driveway in... I think he lived in Geneva, didn't he?
I think, yeah, Monaco. No, he lived in Monaco for a good while,
okay.
Didn't he? Oh, he probably lived in both of them, Rich. I don't bloody know.
That's reminding me of... There's a mutual friend of ours who interviewed Sir Rog in Monaco... for a TV show.
Really?
And they agreed to meet on the quayside and do the interview there. So they've set up, they're all ready for it, and they've got the camera set up, crew are just waiting around. This mate of ours is directing it, so he's there and he's a bit nervous. And then suddenly along the quayside comes this vision in stridently coloured trousers. I think they were red. And it's
red.
Yeah. He's very much a blazer and trouser combo kind of bloke in real life, isn't he? Certainly in his later years.
Yeah, he was. And what's the neck scarf? It's a cravat. He's a cravat man, wasn't he? Was he cravat?
Yeah. I mean, you're saying that, and I'm assuming yes, because, of course, Sir Roger Moore and cravat goes together like Sir Roger Moore and some beautiful slip-on shoes with a sort of gold detailed buckle. Yeah, exactly.
I think he went well with the nautical blazer, which had undertones of military service, high-end military service.
Yes, I mean, it's not just your common a garden yacht twat blazer. It's like a proper sort of, it's like, were you in the Navy? Submarines, maybe?
Yeah.
Might have been. So
in the same way that Stirling Moss always had a lot more sort of jewellery, jingle, than I ever expected.
Yes.
A lot of jingle.
Pour one out for Sir Stirling Moss. May he rest in peace as well. That was some sad news.
It was very sad.
I felt a bit bad because I was slightly flippant. I put a message on Twitter because I never met. Did you ever meet Sir Stirling?
I did briefly. Yes.
Everyone I know who met him said he was really nice.
He was a charming guy, and I've spoke to him on the phone before I ever met him. Him and his wife, and they just their landline. She just picked up the phone and then passed me over to Stirling. It was just so normal. But he was a really, really cool guy. And I know this is nothing to do with James Bond, but what I love the most about him is that he was so unashamedly interested in cars that were fit for purpose. Just because he'd driven powerhouse motorsport cars, he still loved his Smarts and he loved his Twizy and he loved, you know, he was into all sorts of little cars because he lived a city life, didn't he?
Yeah. I was going to say he had Smarts, so he was sort of quite an early adopter of Smarts, I think, wasn't he?
He was. Yeah, he was. He was. I think he was an ambassador of Mercedes anyway because of his SLR days. But
that's pretty cool, though, that he's an ambassador for Mercedes because, you know, he did some good driving and stuff for them. And
he did some fairly fast driving.
They said to him, so Sir Stirling, obviously, as a valued ambassador of the brand, which of our fine cars would you like? And he went, Smart, please.
Yeah.
Right. You don't want a 500 SL? Nope. Just a Smart. That'll do me nicely. That's actually pretty cool.
That's why he was the dude, in many ways, aside from the driving talents and aside from the fact that he was a real gentleman.
Yeah. Hearing this week from people who actually knew him, or last week, was that he was really, really nice. And he was really nice with people who actually didn't know him, but, you know, journos who had to go and talk to him. He was very generous with his time. And there's a fantastic story from a guy that we know. Do you remember the old Mercedes PR guy, Rob Halloway, who now works is their marketing boss? And he knew Sir Stirling and his wife quite well. And he wrote a lovely blog on the Mercedes website about it. And one of the things he said was that there's a story that Stirling Moss tells. I can't remember which story it was, but he told it to this guy, Rob, and then later Rob saw him speaking and he told the same story again, and then Rob saw a video of him from years ago telling the same story, and he said, Stirling, that's not a new story, is it? But I can't believe, when you told it to me, it sounded like it was the first time you said it. And Stirling Moss went, well, it was the first time you'd heard it, Rob. And so he just, you know, like, that's a man who's putting the work in. He's not just phoning in the anecdotes. He's like, I'll give this the oomph it requires to make it a good and entertaining story for someone who's not heard it before. And I just thought, well, from a sort of broadcasting point of view, that's professional. But from a social point of view, that's just somebody who's still interested in people. And I think that's probably the more telling thing.
I think it's because he was one of the first racing drivers to have almost a bigger career out of the seat than in the seat.
Yeah.
Because he quit while he was ahead, because I think he realised he was probably going to die as a driver, but realised that there was ways to make money and stay relevant out of it, and I've got so much time for him, because he realised you could monetize all of that, but not in a horrible way, not in a kind of brash way. But yeah, I have to say he was very cool. He was a very, very cool guy.
He did once say to a friend of mine who was trying to book him for something, and the Sterling came back with a fee, which was quite chunky. I think my friend said, "Oh, that's a bit more than we've really got to pay. I mean, it's probably like twice what we could actually pay. Can we negotiate this at all?" And at some point in the negotiations, which were done in the sort of gentlemanly way that you would hope, but apparently Sterling Moss actually said, "Look, my name is all I've got, old boy." And
wow.
You realise that's it. Yeah, he had to use his name and his reputation to earn a living for decades after he'd stopped racing. So, yeah. Well, anyway, so I was worth diverting, because I just thought it was really sad news. And I felt bad because I was a bit flippant on Twitter, and I said I'd never met Sterling Moss, but I had heard him speak at events quite a few times. And he always used to somehow manage to slip in a reference to Crumpet and be slightly sort of ding-dong Terry Thomas about things. And it used to make me laugh. There was one, I went to a Jag thing. It was like the opening of the Jag production line at Solihull for the XE. And he stood up and it, of course, I've driven Jaguars for years and many happy memories. And I say the one thing about Jaguars is always they were crumpet catchers, and you could see the PR people suddenly going, oh no,
world's media's
here, and he's gone off on a crumpet avenue. But I just thought he was incorrigible in that respect. It just never changed, which is great, because he lived in a world that most of us can only imagine. But
totally.
Anyway, there we go.
You know
what?
I would love to find an ex-Sterling Moss smart car that's still out there with his name on the V5, especially if it was a Roadster. I think he had a smart Roadster.
Did he?
I think he had a Roadster.
Ah.
I might be wrong, but I would love it if I could find one that he'd owned in the past. Just a regular one, doesn't have to be anything special, but just to know that it was Sterling Moss's smart. I just think that's brilliant.
I reckon it would be in good nick as long as the next people had looked after it, because I bet he was a good, sensible, smooth road driver. I could be wrong. Maybe you absolutely thrashed the crap out of them. But
as we all know, the early Smarts gearboxes were unforgivably slow. And I do wish that the one mod that Moss made to his Smarts was he just took it straight to Hewland or Quaife and had a sequential box button with a really tall wand in it for like really inappropriate city use. So he just smashed, clutch to go into first, and then just smashed through
smash
the gears.
It.
Back. You're into sixth within, 40 yards away from the lights.
You have to remember to knock it down to first as you come to a halt, old boy. Otherwise, you're in terrible trouble.
You are in terrible trouble. Yeah.
Just popping out to get some milk.
It sounds like it's really going fast and then the Smart slowly goes by, but it's just tearing through gears. He's had the final drive gears made really loud.
Incredibly
somehow.
Short geared so that it could just absolutely... So yeah, he's definitely into sixth before the end of the Muse.
Oh, completely.
Anyway, well, that was worth diverting just to say. I thought it was very sad. About that.
Let's go back to Bond's cars. Well, are we talking Bond's B-side cars?
Hang on. So, well, first of all, I was going to say, this mate of ours, I don't think you knew about this, but he interviewed Sir Rog on the Quayside in Monte Carlo, and he's got proper old school manners. So he walks down the Quayside, he arrives at the film crew, they're all a bit like, oh, Sir Roger Moore's here, but he's with Mrs. Moore, or Lady Moore, whatever.
Yeah.
And so our mate the director goes, Sir Roger, welcome, thank you for your time, I'm Liz, and this is the cameraman, and this is the sound recordist, and this is our researcher, and he's all a bit wittery, and Rog stands there listening, not saying a word, waits till our mates shut up, and then just says, "Gentlemen, my wife Christina." And I thought, that's beautiful. That's old-fashioned manners, that. Introduce
that
the lady first. So, yeah, but Rog, Sir Rog's driveway. Sake of argument, it's the Geneva house or the Swiss house, the one where he lived when he used to bother David Bowie in the 70s. And yes. He's got one white Lotus Esprit. It's all wet. So that's okay.
What, as in it smells a bit fishy?
It's got wet, weedy. Yeah.
Kelp. You know, like kelp that's been sun-dried. It's horrible. It's really horrible.
Oh, God, yeah. Somehow it's fishy, even though it's not, just because it's been near fish.
Yeah.
And it's salty and...
Salty nonsense.
Salty nonsense. That's not great. He's got a brown Esprit that's exploded, so that's just a shell. Again, project that he's never got round to.
Well, you know, the original submarine car got found, didn't it? Where did they film it? In Bahamas or somewhere? It got found about 15 years ago. It got found in the undergrowth.
Was it found in a shipping container or something? It had just been dumped somewhere.
Was that the one that Elon Musk bought?
I
think it was the one, but that car used to live in Cumbria at the Cars the Star Museum. You know that strange museum in Cumbria that was on the back of a bungalow owned by a dentist?
Yeah, whatever happened to that museum? Closed down, didn't it?
Yeah, I tried to do a thing with the guy just before he closed. He decided to retire and instead of selling the cars off individually, all the cars got put through... they got shipped to Florida and they got auctioned in the States because I think he was going to get more money for them all. And most of the cars ended up staying in America, I think.
Oh.
The Mad Max... Because he had the original Mad Max car. He said he used to get weekly death threats, letters, from car enthusiasts in the States, Ford car enthusiasts, who said that car should never have left Australia. I mean,
oh my
really.
God. I thought you could say weekly death threats from Mel Gibson.
Mel's been through some rocky times. I'm sure Mel probably...
yeah, Mel's back on the source and sending death threats to a Cumbrian man. That's interesting. I never knew that. Does that mean that someone in America owns Del Boy's van?
I think it might be. I have to look up what happened to that museum. It was a cool place, though. Really, it had some unbelievably good cars.
I never went, and it always struck me as... But I saw what was in there, and it was always like, this is legit. You know, it's some proper kind of... Like the Mad Max car, you know, original movie cars that other bigger museums would have paid good money for. Particularly like in America, you know, where they sort of... got a bit more cash perhaps, or you know, someone like Universal Studios might have wanted some of the cars from Universal Movies to put on display, but instead some bloke in Cumbria's got them, which
he did the deal on loads of them, like as soon as filming had finished, and
hanging around the set just behind the tape, behind the cord.
Well,
going, when you're done with that,
The For Your Eyes Only two CV cars. One of them was kept by Citroen, and the other one was bought by a man in Leeds called Nigel Wild, who still has it.
How do you know this?
And he lives in an old church. Because he's crackers, and I interviewed him once.
you could be making this up, and I wouldn't know either way.
No, it's true. In fact, I wrote a feature all about... This was a long time ago. I wrote it in Practical Classics magazine, all about Bond's best B-side cars. So none of the Astons, none of the really heavy-hitter sports cars, but all the B-side toss that was driven by people... And one of them being the For Your Eyes Only 2CV. And the main stunt car lives in Leeds. Nigel Wild bought it off Pinewood Studios. The stunt man and builder of the car was Ken Shepherd. And
this is good knowledge.
It had the flat four GSA Citroen engine so that it could go much quicker. It had a fuel tank that was a pint of fuel.
Really?
It only carried a pint of fuel. It was just a bare minimum stunt tank, apparently, for when it was doing the big jumps and like the smashing through olive trees.
Do you know what? Another mutual friend of ours, Jason Barlow, is writing a book about Bond cars.
Is it?
And he's been working on it for ages. I think he's finished it now. He's been doing it for ages because he told me he was doing it, and then I just kept hassling him to make sure he included all of those B-side ones that you're talking about, which he was anyway. But I was just being a nuisance. I just irritated him for a while.
That would be a great book.
It's definitely got a Renault 11 in it, right? And yeah, it'd be great. No, I can't wait for it to come out. And, you know, Jason's a great writer and he's put his a lot of work into it because he was like, it's really boring to do the, you know, the ones everyone knows, the Diving Esprit and the DB5. It's like a bit more fun to go, now let's get the background on that GTV6 that Roger Moore stole in Octopussy.
One of the cars, I'm sure it was my favourite Bond film, Live and Let Die. I am sure that Roger Moore, when he first goes onto the island and just pretends, doesn't he pretend he's with his newlywed wife and he's on his honeymoon? They drive their hire car is a 1963 Chevrolet Impala convertible, I think. And I actually think that's one of the coolest Bond cars ever. It's not a proper Bond car, but it is, if you know what I mean.
What, because it just gets them...
sat in it and drove it, therefore it's a Bond car.
Well, I mean, if you take that to its nth degree, there's loads of them. There's, you know, probably if you went back through some of the 70s ones, there's a bit where, you know, Roger Moore briefly drives a Maxi or something, but it just doesn't get the credit that it deserves.
Well, of course, Man with the Golden Gun with all those AMC cars. What was Bond driving then? Was he driving an AMC Matador or an AMC Hornet?
Does he? I can't remember now.
Because he's chasing the Man with the Golden Gun and he's about to do the barrel roll stunt.
Oh, of course he is, yeah, because he does the barrel roll in AMC, doesn't he?
He does the barrel roll in an AMC Matador, I think.
Or is
Man with the Golden Gun in Matador.
I think it's...
A Hornet.
Yeah, is it a Hornet X or something like that?
Yeah.
I don't know, American...
But AMC blanket sponsored all of those cars.
Yeah, they did, didn't they? Because it's like, it's shot in... Where is it shot? Where...
It's shot in Slough.
Yeah. Was it? They just did a lot of green screen.
No, I don't.
That's it, because they're definitely driving on the left in the movie and the AMCs are all left-hand drive and it doesn't quite make sense, but... that's the power of product placement for you.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of that. Because Dr. No, which was the first Bond film, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm saying that slowly because I'm trying to double-check
in
my
case.
mind.
But no, there was that first one, James Bond Goes to Dorset, where it's a bit slow. Generally isn't considered canon anymore.
Because Dr. No, there was no Aston, was
no.
there?
No.
There was a Sunbeam Alpine.
Oh, yes.
Convertible, which is, strictly speaking, the very first Bond car on screen.
Hey, see, doesn't get much credit, does it?
No. Yeah. And you see, they're actually a nice car and still not worth a great deal. And doesn't he get chased on a mountain pass by some guys in a pre-war LaSalle hearse, I remember, which is LaSalle was a name that got bought up by Cadillac, so it became a Cadillac, but it's like a pre-war hearse.
Well, and LaSalle the bought by Cadillac or Chrysler?
Oh, bugger. Hang on, Richard.
You're
shoulder barging me now. I don't know. I don't know. I'm just drinking coffee at home.
Sorry, I've put unnecessary pressure on you now.
Can I check? Maybe it was a Mopar purchase.
Well, anyway... So
No. What do you mean? Anyway, no.
You're right. I know. Facts
going to look it up now. LaSalle.
But I was going to say this brings me to Connery's warehouse of Bond cars that he was allowed to keep would have Sunbeam Alpine in it. Quite nice. Obviously, it's got a silver DB5 in it, which, you know, that's almost like his pension. And then he's got a Mustang Mach 1. Miraculously drives on two wheels and then flips onto the other two wheels in the world of poor continuity.
Yeah, what film was that? Wasn't You Only Live Twice, was it? Was it?
No.
Which one was that?
Oh, God. I just watched the other night that episode of Alan Partridge where he eventually shouts at the other people, "Stop getting Bond wrong!" And I feel like we're now doing that. Because I could never... I think people... I like a Bond film. But I always think there's a threshold above which if you like Bond a bit too much, then...
It takes the shine off it.
Yeah.
It becomes too intense. Is that what you mean, people
who are too into Star Wars or tennis or... cars. Oh no, wait, not cars. Have you found your LaSalle answer yet?
Yeah, it was Cadillac. It was manufactured by General Motors.
Sorry, I've
That's okay. I just
false pedantry.
What, This is what Smith and Sniff podcasts are about. It's getting it wrong on air and then writing those wrongs immediately. And that is what our listeners command.
Well, on that note, I've just looked it up. The Mustang Mac 1 was in Diamonds Are Forever.
Oh, that's right. Which I always used to call Diamonds Are For Heather, which was one of my mum's friends. And we always used to whenever
Diamonds Are For Heather.
They glint in your eyes when you touch them.
Yeah.
What's your favourite Bond tune to sing to yourself for no reason?
Probably Living Daylight. No real reason. It's just that, yeah, I don't know why, but if I was caught unawares, softly humming to myself while cleaning the kitchen or something, then it would probably be sort of Living Daylights or View to a Kill. I think it's more that it's the kind
of... View to a Kill's good, with lots of orchestral hit keyboard.
Yes.
But sound effects.
Bam. With bam,
dun,
bam, bam,
dun, dun,
bam.
Dun, dun, dun,
yeah.
Dun, 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 dun. Meeting you with the view, me
now,
in the style of a cabaret singer. Happy to face you, happy to face you, standing still.
I was going to say going back to Sir Roger Moore's Geneva Driveway, which has got a wet Lotus, a burnt out Lotus. An Alpha GTV 6, a stolen GTV 6 on it.
Is it permanently wet?
Yeah,
like a water
you can't feature? Just can't shift the damp somehow. It's
oh, that's great.
You could get in it and go, bloody hell, Roger, you want to get some silica gel in here?
It's like a creepy sculpture that sometimes apparently cries blood. You know, like one of those things where people go, oh yeah, that's totally haunted. It's constantly wet. Nobody can dry it.
Yeah. It's been over 40 years. How is the esprit still wet? I simply don't know. There must be some moisture traps somewhere inside. And again, he keeps meaning to send it back to the factory. They'd probably do him a solid and rebuild it for a, you know, mates rates kind of price, but he just never gets round to it. So it sits there. And of course, it's always steamed up, so he can never use it.
Oh, awful condensation.
But then...
It's, like you said, it's just full of silica gel.
The 2CV, I imagine, works, but is incredibly battered. So it's, you know, it's a little bit dinged up. And it's probably...
Christine didn't like it.
Yeah, she's Christina. Oh, just sell it to that man in Cumbria. No, it has sentimental value and it was a gift. It would be rude to sell it on. And so instead, that's his sort of daily driver because it's at least it works. Because then next to that, there's half a Renault 11, which is of no use to anyone.
I would love to build one of those. I have to say, I've thought about this so many times of just buying an MOT failure that's got a bit of back end rot and going, I've got a solution here. Relocate the fuel tank, chop it off, put some very small caster style wheels on the rear. Number plate on the back, stunt four point harnesses on the front seats. Boom! I reckon I could get an MOT on that.
Does any part of the British MOT test stipulate that the car must have the same number of wheels that it left the factory with?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think it does either.
I think you could put one wheel on the back, and as long as the tyre is legal, I'm not sure it would need a handbrake. It would need a handbrake, the operable handbrake.
Or that's
some of those French cars have front handbrakes anyway, so maybe it was all front.
Because it's like that weird quirk with spare tyres, where it's like if your spare tyre is bald, that's an MOT fail. But if there's no spare tyre, they can't fail you for it. And I know this because I learnt it. But when the spare wheel on my old Ford Ka was stolen, because it had one of those underslung spare tyres, you know, like a Peugeot. Someone nicked it. Yeah, just nabbed it. And it was just before it was due its MOT. Because the spare wasn't bald. It was brand new. That's why they nicked it, I guess. But I was like, oh, no. I'm going to have to get a new spare straight away because it's got the MOT tomorrow. Mm. And then I realised that if there's no spare, that's not a fail. It's just not there. Because that was around the time when lots of cars were suddenly coming without one. So maybe if they go, right, let's check the back axle. Oh, there isn't one. Oh, well, we can't fail you then for worn brakes on the rear axle if you've taken it off this Renault 11.
Well, look,
strange man.
Two stories here, quickly, to just go off on another kind of siding. First one, when I was at college, a guy we used to hang around with in town who ran a scrapyard in a few towns away called Greasy Mark. And he was very greasy. Greasy Mark. Yeah, honestly, Greasy Mark, shout out to Greasy Mark. He's a very cool guy. Oh, very clever. He just used to build. Every Friday night, we'd go out on the town. There'd be some street racing and things. He would always bring a different car. He had a Jag V12 trike. He had a Mark II Escort van, which had three other cars stacked on it in the scrapyard. He one day got bored and lifted it out, hammered the roof back out, and put RS2000 running gear in it, which he just found. And it was so quick and dangerous. But then one day in the summer, he phoned ahead and said, "You're going to hear me before you see me. See guys tonight." He bought an XR3i that had a massive rear end shunt, and he chopped it in half behind the front seats and did exactly what I just said. He put a one wheel on the back, he put a trailer board light set up with a piece of plywood behind the seats, and he put racing harnesses on it and drove it into town. And it was so fast, because it was half the curb weight, it flew. It actually flew. And the fuel tank was relocated to the footwell of the passenger seat. So you had your feet on the fuel tank. But it was so good. And it cost him about 40 quid.
You've just reminded me of something. When we were doing the grand tour with the tent and the second series where Amazon were really insistent that we should have celebrities on.
I remember that.
And have a track again. And we ended up with those Jag F-types. But before that, and it had a sort of gravel, it was going for a sort of rallycross vibe. But
rallycross,
that,
I remember, yeah.
We were just going to have a smooth tarmac track, but it was quite small, and we were trying to think of what to do. And we had built a prototype of exactly what you're describing, except without the back wheel. I think it just had casters on it. Like sort of heavy-duty casters, made out of an Alpha 156. I think it's part of the joke was it was half a Romeo. And we did a load of tests.
Oh, gosh. Half a Romeo.
Did a load of tests with it, and we got the presenters down to drive it. This was filmed as well, just for so we could watch it back for internal use. But so the footage exists somewhere, but we got the presenters driving it, and then we got some people from the office, including like people who are sort of, you know, production management things, who would never claim to be experienced or good drivers, just to see if someone who wasn't a particularly experienced driver could handle it. And the answer was no. It
was. I was going to say the answer was universally no.
It was so bad. Even I can't remember if we let Abby have a go in it. But I think we had another couple of racing drivers that we used to use just for sort of precision driving the camera cars and stuff, and we let them have a go in it. And even they struggled, because it just span like a top.
So quick.
And sort of alarmingly quick and noisy, and with a sort of white spirit bottle in the passenger footwell as the fuel tank, because obviously the back's gone. I've forgotten about that, but it was a dumb idea, as it turned out, because the car was lethally undrivable, and we were about to ask actual celebrities to get in it. So that idea got binned off.
Well, can we put this request out? I mean, obviously Jeremy Clarkson's listening to this, and
obviously
James May and Hammond and all the producers that you've worked with, they're obviously all subscribers to this podcast. But can we see some of that footage? Can we regurgitate it? Just put it out there. I think it would be great to see it.
Well, do you know what? I've got it somewhere, because it would have. I don't know. Actually, that's a good point.
Can you get it?
No, I probably wouldn't, because we'd move to a remote viewing system by that time. But anyway, yes, there is footage, because there's footage of. I just remember there's footage of some of my colleagues from the office kind of screaming as the car rotated. In fact, I think it might have got to the point where Jeremy had a go and he couldn't complete a lap of this little track, basically a go-kart track that we were going to use.
Because it was too spinny.
Without spinning, yeah. And Jeremy's a good driver, but it was his idea. So there came a point where he just had to go, right, that's not going to work.
And well, where does the car live now? Was it just weighed in?
I don't know. Probably. I mean, it was what I'd generously call a prototype, just to get the idea, you know, shaken down, if you like, and then I think we would have tidied it up a bit for filming, but so it was just a 156 that had been spliced.
The jagged edges.
It was like
the
cheapest 156 we could find on Autotrader or eBay or something. So, yeah. Anyway, we digress. I was going to say, actually, talking though of spliced cars. Well, you know, it would have been in the late 80s, after View to a Kill came out with half a Renault 11 in it, that some neighbours of my parents, Neil and Audrey Mallion, they were from Yorkshire. Always, the house was always too hot for some reason.
Neil and Audrey.
Neil and Audrey. And yeah. They were like posh Yorkshire from Harrogate or somewhere, but living in Cheshire.
House was always too hot. That's very
un-Yorkshire. Yeah, it's weird. The house is always really hot, really hot. Anyway, they had a Renault 11 that they bought second hand. And then it came to light that it was a cut and shut. And they discovered this because one day Neil was washing it. It was silver, I think. And he was washing it and some of the paint started coming off the back, revealing blue paint underneath. And then he sort of started digging into it and found that it was two cars welded together. But I wonder, maybe it was an ex-View to a Kill stunt car that they just spliced to a blue one that had a frontal impact. I don't know. It was...
Just remind me, was View to the Kill where they were in Venice with the gondolas? Or was that Octopussy?
That was Octopussy, wasn't it? We're getting Bond wrong again. I think that was Octopussy.
Was he? I'm getting my latter-day Roger Moore Bonds mixed up.
View to a Kill was Roger Moore's last one, wasn't it?
And where he was 104.
He was 104, and there's that great bit where he has to run up the Eiffel Tower by the steps.
That's
and
true.
And in the wide shots, it's very obviously a stuntman, because they're much thinner and faster than Sir Roger. And in the close-up shots, it's a wheezing old man in a corset. No disrespect to Sir Roger Moore, who I bloody loved, and he is, I think, my favourite Bond, because, you know, everybody loves the Bond of their childhood, don't they? But
Me too.
He is visibly knackered. Although that's also because, have we talked about this before, that Roger Moore couldn't run? He's just had no technique. He couldn't run. And when he did, what was his first movie? Live and Let Die, I guess, wasn't it?
Live and Let Die, which is my favourite, yeah.
And he said to Guy Hamilton, the director, before they did a sequence, for the first sequence where he's supposed to run, he went, Guy, I warn you now, I can't run. And Guy Hamilton went...
What do you mean he can't run?
Well, that's the thing. Guy Hamilton went, of course you can run. And at that point, he's quite a young man, relatively, and he just went, of course you can run, Roger. What are you talking about? No, I'm telling you now, Guy, I can't run. Just look, you can just run. It's a very brief shot. It was that bit in the, you know, when he goes to the little airfield and he nicks the plane and biffs the wings off and stuff.
Yes.
And he's got to run. I think they're shooting at him and he's running. He's got to run
away
from
airside.
Them.
Yeah,
airside. Yeah. Good lingo. And so they go, okay, we've got the shot set. All you've got to do is run from the hangar there to you know, behind that plane there. That's all you've got to do, Roger. Go on. I've told you, I can't run, but okay, I'll do it. And so action. And then he's just a sort of flailing mess of limbs. And he doesn't look like a secret agent at all.
If you can hear in the background, there's a military plane going over.
Oh, really?
It's not my doing. It's not my kids or my wife.
We've
it's
had
definitely
that.
A military plane.
We've had one of those ruddy, huge C-17s go over and a Hercules. It's like the RAF have gone, what, no other planes? Brilliant. And they've started just dicking around. It's crazy.
I love Hercules.
They're
like
good,
the
aren't they?
Faithful.
Yeah, there's something very... I think they share a quality with the 747, which is there's something quite noble about them. They look like hard-working planes that don't make a fuss about having to work hard.
It's the Hercules is the sort of Vauxhall Omega of the air. it just got on with it. It just gets on with it. It's a pretty well put together car. It's just it doesn't get a great deal of credit. It just cracks on.
Wouldn't you have said it's more like the Transit of the air?
Okay, yeah. Okay, what Transit Connect or full or long?
No, full size. No, full size. Classic Transit. Although I realise I've just said it wrong. Of course, it is Transit.
Oh, I was going to say what you're talking about.
Stuart. Anyway, yeah, so Roger Moore couldn't run.
You're going to meet me at 7, round the back of Mecca Bingo. You're going to be in the transit.
I like the idea as well.
He's going to bring the scorp.
You ask someone to come round and just sort of mend some stuff in your house, and they go, listen, mate, I'm going to get the big ladder out. It's out in the front in the Hercules. I'm sorry, the what? Yeah, I chopped in the old transit. I've got a four-engine propeller aircraft now.
Sure,
with
spacious.
No wings.
Yeah, if I had to take the wings off. Got inspired by that Bond movie where he knocks the wings off the plane. That Roger Moore couldn't run. He's just flailing arms.
It's just passed me by, that has.
Go and watch that film. Go and watch that sequence film again. And watch what happens when he has to run. He runs behind some luggage carts so you can't see his arms and legs. And that's why you don't see Roger Moore running for any great distance in any Bond film. And I suppose why, even on the steps of the Eiffel Tower, where he was also old and tired, it cuts in just as he's sort of coming to the top of a flight of stairs going, oh, rather than having to see any sort of a wide shot where you can still see his face. And the very just do very wide shots, and they get a stuntman in to spare his blushes.
Do you know, by the way, I realised that saying "you know" really quickly is very Essex.
Do you know?
And Rylan Clark Neal's very good at "you know," just starting sentences with "you know." I don't know how you spell. How do you spell "you know"? Is it J A?
No, I think it's
N O
D J N O.
Oh, it's D J
or D.
Right.
Would it be D apostrophe J N O? Do you know? No, maybe not.
Right. Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
But I the reason why I said this is because I wanted to change the subject. I'm watching a lot more films than usual at the moment, and my wife's quite into the Marvel stuff, and I'm not. And she put one on the other night. She'd already started watching it. I'd had to do Carol doing some work. I walked in the lounge, sat down. I realised it's fucking boring. Really. I mean, it does nothing for... It's just stupid, just overlaced CGI bollocks. I just could not get my head around it. And it was Avengers Assemble or something. And, okay, I don't mind it in dribs and drabs. I don't mind a little bit of Tony Stark here and there or whatever.
But were you sitting there just going, this is rubbish, there's no Avengers in it at all?
Oh, that, do you know what? That's when I had my light bulb moment, Rich. I sat there and went, Avengers Assemble. Right, it's 50 years of the Hillman Avenger this year. It's the 50th anniversary.
Is it?
Let's do a documentary on rebuilding an Avenger. Let's call it Avenger Assemble. Let's do this. Let's do this.
I sort of feel like this is this...
No, this is not a headline leading a documentary. It's not that.
Is it not?
No,
okay.
It's not.
You think the subject matter has enough integrity that the headline is okay?
Absolutely. There's no way that it doesn't.
Good.
There's no way. But then I was trying to work out, would I rather watch just sort of overly complicated storylines involving superheroes disagreeing with other superheroes, which I just think is pointless, because like the whole point of superheroes is they help other people, right? They don't like bicker. That's just shit.
Well, I mean, it's probably...
Come on.
The argument is it's giving them more of a human quality because they are, after all, just like us. And although they have superpowers, they also have our frailties and failings, as well as their incredible abilities to save the world.
Well,
I don't know.
No,
I'm just spitballing.
They've all had troubled upbringings. I get that, but we can gloss over that in 25 seconds.
Are you saying you want your superheroes to be really, really superficial? That they just just sort stuff out and then fuck off.
I think like Thor. I think Thor should ride like a really 80s. Japanese impersonation of a Harley Davidson, for example, with a big sissy bar on the back and horrible graphics, with denim waistcoat on.
Off the base, off the back of this, I'm sort of curious,
with a hammer
but at the same time frightened of the idea of.
Did he has a dream catcher?
Johnny Smith's Marvel Universe, in which.
Well, Tony Stark, clearly. Instead of having a suit that goes around himself, he just clicks his fingers and it's just an indestructible Hillman Avenger with lots of technology in it, and it can change into other stuff. So
wouldn't it be more like an old Volvo 245?
Yeah, actually it probably would, thinking about it.
Swedish Iron Man.
He'd be way more laid back. Way more than Stark.
Yeah, very. He'd do more public works
Yeah, it'd be less brash.
In a very Scandinavian way, yeah.
A lot less brash.
Very comfortable with nudity for some reason. when he was out of his Iron Man suit / Volvo. I'm actually seeing Volvo 244. I think it's sort of somehow earlier. Cooler for Swedish Iron Man.
Yeah.
But yeah, his Iron Man suit is just a reinforced but quite standard looking late 70s Volvo saloon.
244. Yeah, I could see that. I could see that. I think there's legs to this. I really do.
I think there is. Write it up.
And if he's Swedish and happy with nudity, does he just, when he's driving, does he just wear a T-shirt but actually nothing else beneath that? So when he gets out of the car, you go, oh, Tony, I think you might have forgotten some other
stuff. You've forgotten to put your bottom bits on. I think also he does a lot of his layer, rather than that sort of very dark and high-tech layer that Tony Stark has, he's got a sort of beautiful, very glassy, but a lot of light pine sort of kind of lodge-style house. And then he swans around that in a robe, which he never quite ties up properly.
Oh, the cord. He lost the cord, unfortunately.
Probably, yes.
In a fight, and he's just never replaced it.
I don't know where it's gone. It's maybe in the boot of the Volvo.
What's his name? Sven Stark?
Or, Stark with two A's in it.
Oh, yeah. Starkson. Very Norse.
Tony Starkson.
Yeah.
Well, just casually like that, we've just come up with a new movie franchise.
We've just changed suddenly I'm interested in the Avengers slightly.
Yeah, there we go. Job's a good one. Well, this feels like probably quite a good point to wrap things up. Also, I've got another call now with Pierce Brosnan. I'm going to go over when I can and help him stick two halves of a BMW Z8 back together, so...
With specialist aerospace glue as used by Jaguar and other car manufacturers?
Don't have any of that. Got some Pritt stick. Should be fine.
At least do some contact adhesive where Piers does one side, you do the other side, you wait for 15 minutes and then you push it together with ratchet straps.
Keep pushing, Bronsman! Keep pushing! I'm pushing as hard as I can!
Yeah, you drink a bottle of Merlot while you're waiting for it to go off. He talks really breathily about his days as Bond and how he took the money for Mamma Mia but really shouldn't have done it.
But if you're standing either side of a ZA, that's going to be tricky because they're quite wide and you're having to go, could you speak up a bit, Piers? I can hardly... You're too breathy. I'm speaking as loudly as I can. This is as loud as I go. I can't... That's a bit Liam Neeson, that, isn't it, actually?
Where does Piers live? Where does he really live?
He lives in Highgate, just up the road from me.
Is that true?
Sorry, was that a factual answer that you're after? He did, because you used to see him in one of the curry houses up there. I didn't, but people did. People talk.
that's great.
On the street, yeah.
Piers Brosnan lived in Highgate. So he didn't live that far away from Brent Cross Shopping Centre where
they filmed that Remote Control 7 series chase, yeah. All right, lads, I'm going home now for the evening. Look after the 7 series, won't you? Because Kirby's promised it to me. You've done what to it? Oh, for fuck's sake.
You dirty little... Oh, you little... I'm not very good at Irish accents.
Well, good to talk.
Well, thank you ever so much for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to subscribe, please do. And give us some positive feedback because it makes us look good. Please, you're more than welcome. We can't pay you, but do it.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Thank you. Bye.